there, and a very good morning to you. And you're very welcome indeed to the programme this morning, and particularly those of you that are driving from two particular counties to Dublin today. Now, we start with the Sunday Times. Operation Chaos. Whitehall secret, no deal plan leaked. Sunday Times obtains the government's classified Yellowhammer report in full. This is not Project Fear. This is the most realistic assessment of what the public face with no deal. Truthfully, there isn't a huge amount that we weren't aware of, but this is it kind of official in what was produced by the British government themselves. Now, Sunday Independent. We must not let this happen again. Drugs freely available in colleges. Minister slams in action. And they have a photograph of Jack Downey's parents, Johnny and Elaine. And they have the story of two boys, one 19 and the other 20, that in recent times have died because of taking MDMA. And those that know about this stuff say there is an awful lot of it about, and it says there that they have them in colleges. It is alleged they also have them at schools. So be informed and be careful. Varadkar's nursing homes revamp plan now, 300 million over budget. You could repeat some of these headlines an awful lot, you know. The Sunday Business Post, spiralling insurance costs may not be tackled for years. Watchdog will not complete public liability study until late 2020. You sometimes wonder why people go into politics and get elected if they just don't want to get on and do things. But anyway, the Irish Mirror is a story about McGregor. He's very often on the front of the Sunday papers, so I presume he's very good for sales. The Irish Sun on Sunday, my general raid hell at age 13. And that's a story about Martin Cahill, generally known as the general. And the Sunday World, cabs, 3 million clamped down, car dealers day from hell as he's clamped outside court. Now, just to look at a couple of them from across the water, Sunday Telegraph, as you know, fiercely pro-Brexit. Downing Street slams, and then in inverted commas, dishonest rebels. Government makes landmark move on Brexit with signing of, quote, commencement order to end rule of EU law on October the 31st. The Observer, Corbyn pleads with MPs, back me now before it is too late. And I don't know, I mean, these kind of ideas should be at least considered. But the mood music coming across is that not a chance would anybody from the Conservatives back Corbyn. But we'll see, stranger things have happened. Now, with us today in studio, Professor Pete Lunn, behavioural scientist with the ESRI, Owen Corrie, editor of Travel Extra, Elaine Loughlin, political correspondent with the Irish Examiner, Malcolm Noonan, Green Party councillor from Kilkenny, and Amy McKeever, editor of Irish Country Living from Tip. And you'd kind of know she was from Tip if you saw her on the telly. Just the mode of dress. Let me start off. There was, well, obviously we were covering it on the programme yesterday with Harry Crosby. There are a number of stories about housing in the papers today, and they would kind of depress you. One is reducing co-living unit to 6 square metres. Another is local authorities turned down 35% of the social housing offered by NAMA. Council website gets over 3,000 tip-offs about empty houses, and Help to Buy overhaul set to close door on new bills. I'm going to start with you, if I may. Elaine, on the coverage, sometimes you get the feeling that it is the person on the street that thinks there's a problem that has to be solved and solved quickly. And then you get the feeling that sometimes the authorities say, oh, but we can't do this and we can't do that and we can't do the other.
Mm-hmm. And I think at this stage, we could have been speaking about these issues 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago now. At this stage, people are just sick, sore and tired of the fact that we have a rental crisis, we have a homelessness crisis, we have a housing crisis, and nothing seems to be done about it. I'm lucky enough that I managed to get a house before the current spike in prices. But there's my colleague.
Did you buy in Dublin?
I did, yeah, indeed.
Did you?
But again, if we had waited perhaps 6, 8 months, we would not have been able to buy just with the rate of increase in prices. But I know I have colleagues, I have friends who are still renting, paying massive rents each month, can't get a house. And as dismal as it sounds, Marion, they're probably hoping that Brexit goes a bit scaways because they might be able to buy a house in that instance. It's a terrible scenario to be thinking about.
That's one of the consequences.
Well, exactly.
They say that the rate of increase has slowed down dramatically in Dublin. Not so much outside of Dublin, but then it hadn't caught up. Malcolm.
Yeah, I heard with interest Harry Crosby's interview, and certainly I think on the day that's in it, Harry threw in a curved ball into the arena of the housing crisis. There's no doubt about it that we're ignoring the fact that Dublin still has potential to increase a lot more housing on existing lands in the city. We're also looking
But we've been talking about that now. Just like Elaine said, programme after programme after programme, that's from my perspective, but from the listener's perspective, from people looking for home perspective, we go on and on and on and on about it.
But we do.
We have the money, we have the land, we mm-hmm. own it, therefore give me houses please, but they haven't come.
Well, I mean, there's two issues with Harry's proposal. One is the ecological issue, which is
birds.
In the birds, yeah, absolutely. Secondly, there's the whole engineering aspect of it, hugely costly to do a project like this.
And he said they wouldn't charge.
Well, that's interesting, yeah. But I think
he said they wouldn't charge.
But just to look at the situation in Dublin now with the amount of vacant buildings that already exist here. There hasn't been a building condition survey done since 2001. There's, you know, we look around the country trying to, at the National Development Plan, at Project 2040, we're talking about creating balanced regional development, we're talking about the Corks, Limericks, Galway and Waterford. And yet there seems to be this continued emphasis. I know there's a massive housing crisis here in Dublin, but we should be looking at creating a much more balanced growth in urban centres outside of Dublin.
Of course. And certainly if you were renting in Galway or renting in Cork, you'd be saying the very, very same thing. Now, the prices mightn't be quite as high. But yes, we have empty houses. Yes, we have land. Yes, we have money. No, we have no action.
Well, I think there is action. I'm speaking from my own experience in terms of Kilkenny County Council. In Kilkenny City, we have a similar crisis. Obviously, it's a much, much smaller scale.
Yeah.
We want people to come in and work. We have got a really award-winning animation studio there that can find accommodation for the workers. And yet, the local authority is trying its best to play catch-up with this major challenge that has been in the offing for a decade or more. It's not like we knew that we didn't know about this.
Mm.
And I do think that certainly there we are starting to make incremental inroads in our own housing situation.
So to Harry Crosby's idea, you say out of the question.
Absolutely.
I also listened to Harry Crosby yesterday and we were just discussing it before we came in. I was quite sceptical of the idea. I've heard it bandied about before, even in recent weeks in the media, and I thought it was going to go absolutely nowhere. He put up a very convincing argument, I have to say, Marion, yesterday, and he's the kind of person that we were nearly saying that he'd sell you a second-hand car with three wheels on it, no bother.
Yeah, but he might send you one with four wheels as well.
He may or may not,
you know?
But I think...
I don't think he's trying to fool anybody here, if that's the point you're making. He is brilliant at explaining his ideas. But it is an idea, and he said it would come, that these Dutch people wouldn't charge, they'd do it just for the land.
Yes, but I think in the whole argument, the ecological impacts of it were perhaps grazed over and secondary to building houses. And while you may say that, you know, continuing with the urban sprawl that we have at the moment also has a massive impact on the environment, you just can't take one bad idea and perhaps replace it with another bad idea. And perhaps there's a third element out there. why aren't we building upwards? There seems to be an aversion in not just Dublin, but Ireland in going upwards. And we even see that now in the Docklands, where there's certain developments where developers would like to add a few extra stories and have been denied it.
OK, Pete Lunn.
Well, I'm struck by the fact that you want to take quite a long-term view on this, Marion, so you're sort of saying we've known this for years.
I think
I think one of the fascinating things here, and you kind of expect someone from the SRI to say this, is that this all started because we underestimated housing need really badly. And once you get behind, and if the economy roars ahead faster than you think, and the recovery actually superseded all expectations, so we ended up with people wanting to come here to work much more than we thought, so we just didn't have enough houses. We'd underestimated housing need. The primary reason that first started all those years ago was because we weren't looking at our own demography and we weren't looking at our own housing need. So the truth of the matter was we didn't know how many houses we need, and then the economy took off and we couldn't catch up, and we still can't catch up. I mean, I agree with all the points that are being made about brownfield sites and about high-density housing now can be done in much better quality than in the old days and in a much nicer way for people to live, where family homes might actually be possible. All these points are right. But the problem is we've been playing catch-up now for 5 to 10 years because we massively underestimated housing need because we didn't understand our own demography.
Well, this is true, but of course we didn't have any money 10 years ago as well. Mind you, we say we have the money now and it's not getting us anywhere.
I tell you what, we had enough money to study our own demography properly enough to realise what the housing need should have been, but we didn't do it.
Right. One of the other stories that will, you know, cause people, you know, great fury, I suppose, is that there were NAMA offered houses to councils. There you go. I don't know whether there were houses or apartments. And 35% of them were turned down. And there were people homeless. I mean, I don't want to sound excessively shocked or anything, but actually I am a bit shocked.
My brother owns our family home and has it with the council now too. But the amount of money that he had to invest into the house to make it appropriate and suitable for any of the schemes was very difficult for a young man to invest in a kind of an older house. And I suppose that's why I wanted to go back as well to the fact that one of the things we didn't talk about was the fact that the retrofit scheme as well for older houses, so for houses that could be suitable, that could be made more environmentally friendly, has been closed down as well, with a lot of people who have invested money in, you know what I mean, we have this climate.
How much does it cost him? Thousands and thousands.
And that's ongoing. So anytime anything goes wrong, you know what I mean, he's constantly invested. It's an older house. It needs probably a lot of investment.
Yeah.
But it is really required. And this is like a country house where there's access to schools, where you know what I mean? And there is, I think, standalone properties like we've talked about here. Like, I don't live in Dublin anymore. I work in Dublin, but I commute, because when I went to buy a house in Dublin 10 years ago, when you said we had no money, I didn't have any money to buy anything. And even with the rent to buy.
Yeah.
In Dublin, like, the amount of money you're talking about is very small. You know what I mean? I know it's important, but, like, you know what I mean? They were talking about, you know, if it was on a €400,000 house. Still, you know what I mean? It's a very small amount of money, €20,000 off a €400,000 house, if you can afford to buy that. The situation is just awful. And then with the students, then we had the department, a couple of different people come out this week making very, you know what I mean, awkward claims about what students, you know what I mean, if you can't go to a regional college. And that's not really fair on somebody whose course is only available in Dublin.
Yeah.
And there is plenty of courses that are only available in Dublin, and that's where they want to go, and that's where they should be entitled to go if they get the points.
There are parts of Europe that have bigger metro transport zones, not just the national transport zone, but bigger reaches of their metro, their subway, their bus feeding the subway services than the country of Ireland. Exactly as Imi was saying, you could get, you know, if we had tackled this as most of the Western European countries have done and put transport infrastructure in place, we would be getting out of bed in Castlebar and going to UCD in an hour and coming back in an hour in the evening. What that does is it also takes out that pressure on the cities and revives young life in the towns and villages of rural Ireland. Now, that's a solution that was there for when the cost of putting the infrastructure in place was considerably less than now. The other, I do agree all the points that are being made and what I see travelling around the world, you don't actually have to go up, but there are better ways of more intensive urban developments.
Yeah.
But the other really big problem is the planning process, where getting something from greenfield to actual build is, it seems to be more convoluted than in any other country that I come across.
Well,
and
when you talk
they're
about
the obstacles. Yeah.
Transport, there was another proposal, kind of a very major proposal, vision, shall we say, about exactly what you're talking about in Metro, or very similar to what you're talking about, to be done by the man that did the Metro in Madrid. Transport Authority didn't want to know. Our plan is the plan, and no.
And Madrid built their metro at less than one third, I think, of the cost of similar costings on our metro, which remains unbuilt.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. But I mean, these visionary types should sometimes be listened to. Anyway, Elaine is right. Build up new homes and preserving the environment. The latter is the most important. Housing, adding another story to the existing housing stock, has potential for hundreds of thousands of new spaces in areas where they are most needed. And that comes from Tom Duffy, who's an architect. Another says, rehousing, we're heading for serious civil unrest. Why are our borders open to non-EU people during a housing catastrophe?
Oh dear.
There are houses with 47 people and 7 to a bedroom, which is illegal, but there are no inspectors. Why is everyone so afraid of building higher? My son lives on a 14-floor apartment in Singapore. Grand. Another one says, how small is size difference between a co-living unit and a grave? Well, I think there's a considerable difference, though. Mind you, you might, if it were stalling up, feel a bit imprisoned, shall we say. Now, we'll move on from that. And the Sunday Times today, very, very... as I say, I think we knew most of what was going to be here before, but kind of this is official. Pete, you want to go through bits that they... Because there are three pages inside where they actually go through what's going to happen to transport, what's going to happen to medicines, what's going to happen to water, all sorts of things.
Yeah, I mean, I think... It's interesting, this. I mean, the Sunday Times never undersells its own exclusives, let's say. So, you know, it's described its own bombshell dossier here. And you always want to see, are the other outlets really picking this up? And the answer actually is they are. I mean, this has now appeared on the front of the BBC website and all the rest of it. This is an important document. This looks like it is a scenario document that's been generated by the Cabinet Office right at the heart of the British government. It's not actually saying what they think is going to happen. It's saying what they think could happen, and it's designed to inform a committee that's trying to mitigate these problems. But the scale of the problems is quite remarkable when you look at it. I mean, sure, we have heard them all, but it kind of collects them all together and makes you realise that right at the heart of the British government, there is an appreciation of the scale of the no-deal Brexit problem, potentially. Now, I actually don't think anybody knows how serious this problem is. I mean, it could be anything from far less than we think to far more than we think. Right? I genuinely don't think anyone has a handle on it. But what we now know... is that right at the heart of the British government, they know how serious it could be.
Right. And how will that be taken by Boris and Dominic Cummings? Because they were given out to the civil service a week or 10 days ago and saying, get your heads changed, because it is believed, rightly or wrongly, that the civil service would have been Remainers, and behave yourselves and get positive about exit.
In all truth, we don't know. And one of the things that's so remarkable about this, I mean, I've been here now for nearly 20 years, but I mean, I still know the kind of what you might consider the sort of 5 or 6 top political commentators in Britain on this subject, and I'm reading them avidly, and they all differ on what's going on with Boris and Dominic Cummings, what the strategy actually is. You know, is it to take the EU to the brink to try and get a concession? You know, is it just to ram the thing through and hell with the consequences? They absolutely do not know. And I don't think any of us do. But... Yeah, I mean, playing with fire doesn't even come close. I mean, it's not just the consequences. For this island, of course, the real problem are the consequences that are potentially in this
yes,
document.
Of course,
all of the possibility of shortages and delays and data problems and increased crime and problems with online commerce. It's all there. There's masses of it. But from a British point of view, there is also a really serious risk of a constitutional crisis, and there is a really serious risk of violence spilling onto the streets, I believe.
You believe
what
that?
I'm watching now. Yeah, from here,
My goodness. Amy?
I totally agree with you, Marion. There's nothing really... Like, I think every time we've been talking about this, we're talking about the fact that there's going to be shortages. My concern would be that a lot of what they've talking about here is going to spill over here as well. Like, you know what I mean? The tariffs that they talk about on food, different problems like that. That, you know, the islands with the export-import relationship with that we have, it's going to... A lot of these problems are actually going to be Irish problems as well, which will be hugely problematic. And, you know what I mean, considering we use the UK as a land bridge to get onto Europe, you know what I mean, if they're talking about 50 to 70% delays at ports...
Yeah. Now, this, though I did see, and I'll come to Owen on it, I saw an article today to say that getting there by sea will be ramped up from here.
I saw that as well, but in that report, I'm not sure which page it was on, but it does say that, you know what I mean, for perishable goods like seafood, which we would have a market for and a good market for, that's still going to have to go by land bridge because it won't be fast enough. So, you know what I mean, it will be a solution, maybe a possibly more costly solution for certain products, and we certainly should be looking at and investing in those, but it won't be the solution for all the products that we're sending off this island. And I would say, I suppose, well, in relation to food, the problem for, let's say, the beef in particular would be with going into the UK is that problem doesn't come on the 31st of October, it comes on the 1st of October, because any animals that are processed from that point in time, they're going to be hung, they're going to be ready to go.
Yeah, so were you listening to the programme last week and did you hear the remarks?
Oh, I did, yes. Dara's remarks, yes. I suppose Dara, you know what I mean, he writes some days one day and some ways the other way. But
No, he was very clear in his view.
Yeah, he was clear in his view that I would disagree with his view that the sector has no future. I think that there's, you know what I mean, a number of different things, particularly the number of jobs on the island is really important. And the fact that, like, one of the main things that, you know what I mean, you could say is that beef is a product that we produce on this island. We produce it really well to the absolutely highest standard. It is a big employer. It contributes to the economy. And there's tracts of land in this country where we can't produce something else. They,
you can't continue doing it at a loss. Not possible in any business.
Beef has never been produced anywhere except at a loss. If you don't have huge tracts of land, if you can't use growth hormones or, you know, like the likes of products that they use in South America or North America, that, you know what I mean? And that's the problem why we have all this argument about why we shouldn't import products. They're not to the same standard. And I would go back to consumers on all of this. The consumer, we put this, we say we want this, we want it to be, to have a numerous claims on it, but ultimately we don't want to pay for it. So if we want to put these huge standards on our food production, then either we have to subsidise it. Like, we subsidise things so that we can affect behavioural change in people that people don't want to have to pay for, but they need to make those changes. The same as any subsidy or grant that's given out.
But if this goes ahead, if all that stuff in the Sunday Times today comes to pass, I mean, you say that we're great meat eaters. That's very true. 40%, is it, of our beef goes to Britain?
50. But we export 90% and 50% of the 90% goes to Britain.
Yeah, 90% we export.
But I suppose the thing is, well, like, there's another...
So in other words, the 10% is flip-all used to anybody.
But we produce beef. We produce beef. Let's say, if you take the report that came out, the climate report that came out last week, they do say, okay, fine, you know what I mean, there is a call to reduce beef production. But there also is a concern in relation to carbon leakage in that report that says our temperate climate is the best place in the world to produce grass-based beef and dairy. So what they do not want is they do not want our production cut to be replaced somewhere that will actually be a bigger environmental damage. And the other thing as well is, like, it's come up during the week about the retailers. Lidl is in the paper this week saying, you have to pay for it. You have to pay for no deal Brexit. If we're buying something in the UK and we're exporting it to Europe, you're going to have to pay the tariffs. So the supermarket, the big player in this, that nobody knows how much money they're making, is taking a stance.
I'll come back to that in a second. Malcolm.
Yeah, in relation to the beef, I do think that diversification is key here for Irish farmers. And certainly, I think the whole expansionist approach that has been led by the IFA and by government, I think is going to run into huge problems. We've already seen it with them. I'm not sure how the negotiations are going to go with the beef plan movement and with the IFA. They're calling on the minister to come in on that. I do think there's opportunities there too. Gas Networks Ireland have recently began processing and compressing gas that has come from biomethane as a byproduct of the dairy and cattle industry. And I do think there's an opportunity there to produce gas, to run our bus networks, to run our public transport, and to get that value added from it. But ultimately,
and what would the land produce?
Well, the land would still produce beef and dairy, but I still think it has to be reduced, and we think it has to be reduced greatly. I don't think, I would absolutely agree in the sense that consumers need to be aware that the price we're paying for food is continuously dropping. Our income that we spend on food is continuously dropping, led largely by the supermarkets. And we're looking for, I do think that we need to absolutely give consideration to the value added and be willing to pay for a product that is not below the cost of production, that farmers are getting at the very minimum the cost of production out of what they produce.
We're the fifth biggest exporter of beef in the world. It's hard won. It's, we're hard work over decades and decades to win those markets. We should not be thinking about throwing them all up in the air over the considerable difficulties that the single biggest market we're going into is now possibly being shut off. There have been talk of 70% tariffs on it, all of that sort of stuff. We need just to find new markets, and we also need to continue doing what we do really well, which is produce high quality beef and market it well around the world. The environmental damage in other latitudes is much higher than ours. We are the solution to the environmental problem, not the cause of it. And if somebody came into this studio and sort of said, well, maybe we should get out of pharmaceuticals or software, because they're the only two things we do more exports of than agri-food, there would be horror, and I'm quite astounded, not just in this studio, but over recent weeks, that legs have been taken to this debate as, should we be doing beef in the first place? Of course we should. It's what we do. It's what we've been doing for 30,000 years, so let's keep it. We've won those markets. They were hard won, and let's keep them. Let's find new markets. It happened with lamb. It happened with some of the other agricultural products. It's not going to be easy, but in a way, it could be a blessing in disguise, because when you become over-dependent on one market, a big catastrophic jolt like foot and mouth in the early noughties,
yes, yeah,
can cause undue hardship. The key to successful trading is spreading your bets over several markets. This is our challenge and our opportunity for the production of beef.
Right. I don't know. I was involved years ago for something for the Department of Agriculture to try and establish that question that's being asked at the moment, the cost, what's paid to the producer, what they get from the factory, and then where the money ratchets up. And I remember starting off on it, and we had very fine people assisting us and all that, couldn't get an answer.
It's a very difficult one, Mary. Now, in America, if you're a producer in America, the USDA does do a wholesale to retail price, so the producer can see how much they're getting paid, and they break it down into different cuts and vegetables, and it's a very comprehensive. I'm sure there's a lot of work that goes into it, but we've been looking at this for years. In I suppose, jealousy, looking at kind of being able to see the value, because there is a lot of misunderstanding. Different cuts of meat have different values. They're going to different markets. And it's very much not cut and dried, I get this and you get that, or the farm producer pays this.
I've heard it with astonishment that you're not allowed to say what the factory paid you for your beef.
Farmers are not allowed to set prices as such. The consumer, and this would be a major problem, that farmers would believe that the competent authority for consumers are not being fair to them, that they are only protecting the consumer. at the end of the chain, that it's cheap food and keeping the price of things down. So,
then that is not true.
The supermarkets can set their price, the processor can set their price, but the farmer is a price taker.
Yeah, but I mean, does that have to be a secret?
Well, the farmer can say, well, we publish the price of, you know what I mean? Farmers would, you know what I mean, would, you know, in the mart you can see what the price is. The factories would, the department does collect factory prices, but it's an average price. So there's no spread, and farmers would like to see that they could see the spread of the lowest and the highest. This would always be an issue.
Why can't they?
At the moment, it's just not data that's collected. The factory, you know, the factories would consider that to be commercially sensitive data because it would give the farmer something.
Certainly,
you know,
commercially sensitive for the farmer, well, I would have thought.
But if the factories would argue that that would put their business at a disadvantage. So farmers would like to see that because it would give them a better... The problem here is that they haven't got any power to actually negotiate a price. They need to get animals, and the 30-month rule and the 16-month rule do have an impact on that because they have
to... Yeah, when I was looking at those rules about various months and all that... The age of the animal.
So
was that not to do with CJD?
Yeah, well, originally it was to do with those things, but the BSE. But the issue here is that those are supermarket demands. Do you know what I mean? Those are things that are put on the processor by the supermarket that says we want our beef under this age for heifers and for bulls and for steers.
Yeah.
But it does put an artificial time limit.
Okay.
On when the farmer can sell it. So he has to sell the product before this age, which does impact on their negotiating power.
Okay, Pete?
Yeah, so there's a branch of economics that really started up in respect of development economics when people were looking at fair trade with what we then called the third world. And that branch of economics has been going for about 20, 30 years now, where it really has started to look at, is it actually possible for people who are purchasing off, you know, disparate companies or sole traders like farmers, is it actually possible for large companies, even in a competitive market, to just take the lion's share of the surplus, right? And pretty conclusively, over a period of time, the answer to that question is yes, it is. So the excuse that, oh, these are just the market prices, doesn't actually wash. You can pay just the market prices and still be screwing someone. And that's what that economics shows. So it's perfectly legitimate for people to complain that they're not getting a fair share of the surplus. But to see the concept of fair trade actually appearing within our own domestic economy, given where it all came from and how that argument started, is kind of fascinating. I do want to throw a slight spanner in the works, come back to what Owen was saying, though. I mean, you're totally right about the hard-won market. One feels enormous sympathy for any set of enterprises that are struggling in international markets and have fought over years and years and years to establish them. But the truth of the matter is that it's changing and there's nothing we can do about it. We are discovering quite how big the food industry is as a polluter, and stuff has to change to deal with that. Now, of course, the point made earlier is absolutely right. We want it to change in a way that doesn't mean we just sell the pass to, you know, places that are producing beef that actually have lower quality and have worse environmental standards. But if Europe isn't the leader on climate change, nobody else will be, and we're part of that. And we have to start adapting our agricultural sector in the face of climate change, regardless of where we are in markets, because we are the world leaders.
Reduce the beef production, reduce animal production. I mean, what we grow, according to the expert that was here last week, we grow very, very well. We grow grass and we grow trees. That's true. Where we are top of the pops. Yeah. So what do you do?
Well, look, I can't give you a whole bunch of solutions to this, but there are some principles that are really, really important. And one of them is that polluters should pay. And one of them is that consumers who are buying products from producers who are polluting should pay higher prices because those products are polluting. And in my view, as a behavioural economist, should be aware of the scale of pollution that is produced by the products that they buy in the most simple communicative terms. Those are principles that one can put in place in dealing with what we economists call externalities, that is pollution. And in this case, this is pollution that is genuinely species threatening. It is the biggest problem internationally that we face. And we have to face up to those realities now. There's no way of dodging them. We can't simply say, look, we'll just carry on because we're a small country and that's okay. It's not. We've got to start changing what we do.
On.
But do we initiate the change unilaterally? And that is the big question on all of the environmental questions where they have an economic value. Does somebody stand up and say, we're giving up our economic advantage unilaterally and then watch other people move in on your markets. You're right, we should be initiating the change. Europe should be advanced. They should be the beacon for the rest of the world. But abandoning the market, and I'm not suggesting that yeah. you're going that extreme, but even a semblance, even moving in that direction, replace the market and look at the economic viability of everything and the alternatives. But I do think the argument that has not been made strongly enough, and it was great to hear Amy saying it earlier on, is that if the world still wants beef, which it does, we are part of the solution to that, not the problem, because we are producing it with a lower environmental impact.
But will the world continue to want beef is the question, and I would be the first person to stand up for the farmers of Ireland. They produce an absolutely exceptional product, and perhaps they don't fight their own corner enough and don't rave about the great beef that we do produce in this land. And maybe if it was promoted more as an exceptional product that you're willing to pay for. And I'm thinking of the shift as well, where people are, you know, not eating meat on Tuesdays, and that will probably progress in the next 10, 15 years, where the public might say, I'll only have beef once a week. If that is the case, are you going to go for your bargain burgers, or are you going to go for your excellent grass-fed quality product that you're willing to pay a premium for? And
if farmers can afford it, of course. Were problems about burgers before, there were burgers being sold for like 10 pence each. I mean, I don't know the economics no more than anybody else, and how much the farmer got there and how much the factory got there, but you would have to think at a 10 pence each you are not getting the finest product. Malcolm, you want to come in?
Again, on the issue of climate, I think it's still a hugely intensive, energy-intensive industry. And if we're not going to lead on it, as has been said...
Do you think we should give up our markets?
No, I don't think we should give them up, but we absolutely need to diversify. We're very, very prone...
To what?
We're very vulnerable to shocks. I think that to put all our eggs in the one basket, literally, of beef and dairy, I think is very, very dangerous. Here in North County Dublin, there's a horticulture industry that has been wiped out by the supermarkets. And that's, you know, we've had situations where farmers are ploughing their vegetables back into the ground because of the prices being offered by some of the retail multiples. But there's opportunities in other crops, in energy crops, in hemp.
Like what?
Hemp is one of those.
Well, there's a call in there saying the industrial hemp cultivation is an obvious area to explore. The spin-off industries in processing for cloth, paper, hemp, crete, etc. Look to British Columbia for the model.
Say, for instance, we look at our beef market and look more towards Europe. We see Liam Lacey of the Irish Maritime Development Office in the Sunday Business Post saying that we can have a direct route to European markets. We focus on more localised production on European markets, but also focus on diversifying our production into other crops and other land use. Like we said with hemp, like with forestry, like with biomass, short rotation coppice that could be used.
What's a short rotation?
That would be the likes of willow that could be
I was quoting last week, I know somebody who did that, a farmer, and went into a pig, and by the time it came to time to sell it, nowhere to sell it.
Exactly, and it destroyed.
We need a long term plan for this. You know what I mean? I'm not disagreeing with you. You know what I mean? And farmers, Fandara referred to that as well. That farmers are diversifying into different sectors, but there does need to be a plan for the beef sector in terms of long term, because there are parts of this country you can't grow any of those crops, and like Europe recognises the fact that having animals, sheep and beef on these areas is actually hugely beneficial to the fauna and flora of the region.
Okay, we are going to take a break. With us in studio today, Amy McKeever, Malcolm Noonan, Elaine Loughlin, Owen Curry and Professor Pete Lunn. And we'll be back after this.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Tesco Club Card, helping you save more every time you shop. Tesco, every little helps.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, before we move on, a couple of calls that come in. Harry Crosby's proposal is not a complete solution, but one of many solutions. Our problem is closed minds to solutions that we haven't thought of ourselves. We need to embrace change for our future generations. And another one says, outrageous proposal, Marion. Dublin Bay is a hugely important area for birds. Total ignorance of the environment. Haven't we done enough damage already, especially when we have so much land available to build on already? And that comes from Shank Hill. And another one says, Marion, Owen Corrie is right on the money. I'm fed up with the loopy greens attacking our world-class beef industry. Order a steak and be proud. Loopy greens?
Yeah, that's us.
Yeah. Okay, listen, we're going to move on because it's summertime, it's holiday time. People look forward to their holidays. People are doing a lot of flying, which, of course, isn't good for the environment anyway, but we leave that aside for the moment. And Ryanair have taken out big ads. They had full-page ads yesterday about this upcoming, well, we think it's upcoming strike with Ryanair. Your take on this, Malcolm. Did you read the ads?
Yes, we were talking about this. The ads were interesting and certainly not terribly familiar with the whole nature of the dispute. I know the unions have a different take on it. And the ad claims that less than 25% of the Fostra Union members voted in favour of strike action, but it was reported that 102 of 109 pilots actually voted in favour. Now, Owen has will have a more nuanced take on that. I suppose I just have to put the question now. We are talking about environment and climate. Are we looking at the beginning of the end of the low fare
Listen.
Model? And I think that's something, it's a bigger question, but I think these...
But in terms of Ryanair, they've moved... They're recognising unions.
They are.
It was like it crossing the Rubicon.
Time, yeah, it has.
And would you give them any credit for that?
Certainly. I think they're probably new to this type of industrial relations, and I think it's, excuse the pun, a new departure for them. But they will have major challenges as the whole airline industry shifts. And again, I'm not terribly familiar with the runnings of that, but I do think that there is a major challenge for the airline into the future.
Oh, no, I think you're not that nuanced. Reading your notes.
I am. Just the statistic that Ryanair use is slightly spun. It's 25%. They have 180 members. They've just over 500 pilots. So it's they've taken the number who voted and said that's 25% voting for the strike. What has been interesting in the last 12 months is that the trade union, IALPA, represented by Forza, have increased their numbers, and largely this is what has been going on. When you quantify the Ryanair operation across Europe, this is a very, very small number of people, like the 102, 108 people for against the 4,500 pilots they have. What they, right, the backstory here is Ryanair recognised the unions because the growth is what drives them, and they were looking at the big markets that they just need to get a bigger reach into. They only have a 7% reach into the huge French market, and with French labour law, they decided recognising unions would actually make them
a player
and make it possible to base aircraft there. Scandinavia is another one. I think if they think IALPA are troublesome, wait till they sit down with the French unions. But
I have heard the good Mr. O'Leary talking about air traffic controllers in France. He's not an admirer.
They actually caused more strike damage than IALPA, than their pilots, in all the different strikes last year, the French air traffic controllers. The other interesting thing about French air traffic controllers is weather delays go up on Saturday and Sundays. If you go to aviation charts, all the thunderstorms take place on Saturday and Sunday. They lost 1,200 flights last summer. Back to what's going on this week. IALPA have a strike, are sort of team tagging with a British strike on Thursday or Friday. That's really at the core of this. When we had a mediation process with Kieran Mulvey agreed last September, it was effectively abandoned live on air in one of these, I think it may even be this studio, last week. And what we've seen since then is a little bit of throwing the blame in each direction. But the big picture is that Ryanair will probably get back with them and work out some sort of solution to their very technical stuff, the 30-page technical documents that are
being... What is at the heart of it? I mean, in their ads, they're saying that they're the highest paid pilots in Europe, And they got a 20% increase very recently.
And they went back on pay again. And the pay, you know, a union, in this day and age, Marion, a union doesn't go in and say, I want a 100% increase. It all comes down to standby basic pay, demarcation, duty pay. It's all this sort of, and they didn't cost it. So when Eddie Wilson went on Morning Ireland the other morning, some listeners would have heard him, he was saying they're looking for more than the Taoiseach. They're looking for 350,000. He was actually costing it out. What Ryanair will bring in into negotiations is you're better paid than your peers,
yes,
in, which would be Jet2, EasyJet, people like that. What IALPA will come into is, but look what Lufthansa pay. And that's where it gets really complicated, because Lufthansa have a big international long-haul network. Their short-haul is only a small part of the operation.
Right.
And their the average pay is really difficult to actually put up against a Ryanair's basic. Ryanair have one type of aircraft, 737, Boeing 737, short haul. It doesn't fly further than the Canary Islands. And that's where the comparisons that we've been hearing on the airways are all so confusing.
Can
and
I
the
ask
oldest,
you a
oldest
question?
Rule in politics is if you can't convince them, confuse them.
Just as they say, Cash to Gomart. You know, there was such bad feeling between the staff at Ryanair or the non-staff at Ryanair and Ryanair, is it sometimes feels just like personal. I'm not accusing anybody of behaving inappropriately, but that there's such baggage that everybody's carrying with them.
The president of IALPA was libelled by Michael O'Leary on primetime. It's decades of waiting for the union to be recognised and to get back into the game, get back into the play,
yep,
with an airline that hadn't recognised them. Not only does Ryanair not recognise them for all those decades, it used every opportunity to insult them. I mean, you could not have made matters worse. And then suddenly, you know, because of those factors that I'm talking about, Ryanair's recognised the union and now they're back in negotiations. And the biggest problem is it's a public service union, forces a public service union, and they're faced towards one type of airline, which is what they negotiated with, yep, over the years. Aer Lingus, same with BALPA, British Airways, the Germans with Lufthansa, the traditional. But we all know that if Ryanair had been unionised in the 90s, it would not be hit here now. It would not have been able to cope with the demarcation, the technical, the staffing levels, all of the hands, the bureaucracy,
right,
the way airlines were entangled. And airlines that got government Joneses every now and again could get through that. And that really, if you were to sum up in one line, what's been going on this week is we have a 1970s, 1980s model of how pilots should be regulated. You know, I mean, IALPA said there's no pay structure in Ryanair for pilots. This is an airline with 4,500 pilots, and it's the most successful. It's going to overtake the Lufthansa Group, the entire Lufthansa Group, this year. It's three times the size of British Airways. Of course it has a pay structure. But you have this small group, and it may be the 102 who are voted or the 180 who are members, lecturing Ryanair on their pay structure, and that doesn't augur well for meetings to continue in any sort of civilised manner.
Pete, you're the expert here on behaviour.
Well,
I mean, it's, you can, maybe I'm wrong, but you can feel that there is such fury on both sides, each with the other. Meanwhile, the poor traveller, you know, the fella that's working in London during the weekend going back, you know, there are all sorts of people so discommoded.
I've greatly enjoyed listening to Owen there. As a behavioural scientist, there are many phenomena that are coming out sentence after sentence. I mean, absolutely. I mean, I've been a striker. I've been in management trying to deal with a strike. I've been a journalist reporting strikes. And one of the things that's amazing about strikes is what comes out into the public domain is this tiny, tiny little tip of the iceberg of all of the resentments and arguments and personalities and, you know, grudges and arguments about fairness that have been going on over years,
yeah,
and years and years. So it's really interesting and entertaining to hear a little bit of the inside there. Having said all of that, when I see people with six-figure salaries holding out for more money in the economic times we live in, and the victims of them holding out are people who don't have anything like that amount of money. Regardless of all of those intricacies, I do not have a lot of sympathy for them.
For the pilots?
Yeah, they're extremely well paid and they're holding a whole bunch of the public to ransom. And whatever the intricacies of that are, it takes an awful lot for me to have sympathy with them. And as of now, I have seen no decent argument to have any.
Elaine?
Yeah, I think one of the most important things in any dispute is winning the publicity war or the publicity battle. And certainly Ryanair are ahead in this one. When you see the figure of 172,000 for the wage of a pilot, now whether that's slightly spun or not, it's open to discussion. I'm sure the
pilots would say otherwise, yes, since they put it in the paper.
It was in black and white yesterday in the papers. It's in it again today. People, as you said, Pete, that are looking, am I going to be able to catch that flight next week? They won't be too happy seeing that. And it comes in the context as well. We have to remember that Michael O'Leary came out recently and said that he's going to take a 50% pay cut. Now, he'll probably come home with around €1 million still next year when you count his bonus and his pay. But he's taking cuts. He's suffering, I'm sure he'll say himself. And here we have pilots looking for 101% pay increase.
Amy?
Yeah, I think I totally agree. Like what they're trying to do is kill off public support for the pilots. And I think that the line in the ad, the small group of very well paid hope to disrupt the travel plans of thousands of Irish families, brackets, very few of whom earn over 172,000 per annum. Heartstrings, you know what I mean? They are trying to, and it is really important. Like, you know what I mean? I've attended a lot of protests and I've been involved in a lot of strikes, and, you know, having that public perception, that, you know what I mean, support for you to get what you need, it's very difficult. And I haven't seen anything in anything I've read to suggest that they're not getting this money.
Yeah, I just think the one interesting line in the ad as well is the Ryanair fighting for low fares, and is that fighting for? So it's Michael O'Leary showing I'm on your side and I'm on the side of the public for your right to fly to Prague for a stag party.
The simple truth of the history of Ryanair is it has made travel available to people in ways that was never imaginable before. I was working in architecture, which was very, 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 very long time ago, to go to London, return with Aer Lingus, oddly enough, exactly the same price as British Airways, was £216.
The problem here, and we spoke about it with the externalities, Pete spoke about it in relation to the beef industry, and we're not paying for the true cost of aviation or air travel. And then again, it's going to meet up with the climate challenge, as we've said as well here.
Yeah.
And that's the reason I posed the question. Are we looking at the beginning of the end of the low fare model, that it may end up crashing into this type of challenge?
I have another idea. Are we coming to the end of the public giving out stink about Ryanair?
We may have achieved something in the last week, which I did not expect, that public opinion would swing on the side of Ryanair against somebody. Again, the when you look at people who had a genuine cause, the nurses put 40,000 people on the streets. The way the dispute was covered, and the, you know, it'll cost too much to give them any extra money, and compare and contrast with what we've seen in the last week. You know, it's not 1913. These guys are more in common with William Martin Murphy than they did
with
Jim Larkin.
Steady on. That's a bit over the top. I mean, that's what unions do. Unions negotiate pay and conditions.
They're doing their job
for their,
and paying to their strengths. And the real problem, they will not have the impact on the flights. They don't have the critical mass. They may at some time in the future have the critical mass to actually impact Ryanair's schedule, but only about 10-15% of the flights will be impacted.
And you figure that the way they manage the logistics of these things, that the flight to London may suffer, but they'll keep the holiday flights flying.
Particularly if Balpa may be solved before then, but they will protect the sun routes, and they're the ones who are freaking out. They're out of the country, the communication channel from home, and they're trying to get home to go back to school. I'm not sure the children are trying to get home today. The mommies are.
Oh, there's a great commitment in this country to education. Well, we will see what will happen, but that is a clever use if you want to win the war, so to speak, that you protect the people that are kind of down the food chain in terms of strength.
They will do that anyway. They've managed to fly through all the strikes, and there are other unions lining up. I mean, the Spanish, the Portuguese, the Italians, because you've got, in so many markets, you've got this mixture of different unions with different political allegiances. It's what they choose to do. They knew the dangers, and they knew exactly who they would have to deal with, and they're managing their way through it all. The end game is that Ryanair needs to grow at the big growth figures we've seen in recent years, not just 7-8%, back up to 9-11%.
Wow, it's unimaginable.
It's only by recognising unions they'll achieve that.
Okay, we will leave that there for the moment and we'll take a break.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
Welcome back to the programme now. I have a copy here of something from Michael Gove's Twitter, and he says, "We don't normally comment on leaks, but a few facts. Yellowhammer is a worst case scenario. Very significant steps have been taken in the last 3 weeks to accelerate Brexit planning," says Mr. Gove. But there were paragraphs in there saying that it wasn't worst case scenario. But anyway, we will leave that there for the moment. And we will move on to another story that was getting quite a lot of attention during the week and again today. And that's public service cards. Now, one thing is the Taoiseach saying, don't throw away your public service card. Another one, public service card may face fines of 1 million, which I thought was like small change in comparison with the figures that had been mentioned before. And another one saying that privacy, even privacy lobbyists needed to get a pension. Let me start with you, Elaine. What's your reading of the whole story and the coverage?
Well, I suppose from day one, this card has been clouded with controversy. We had back in 2017, the pensioner who had her pension payments paused for around 18 months, suspended, I think, from 2016 onwards, and then that was reversed. And every so often, when there was another item added to the list, like getting a new passport for the first time if you're over 18, there was the school transports appeals, you'd need a card for that. It did seem like it was the nanny state creeping up, or certainly there was commentary around it.
But it's been going on for years. I mean, it started on under Fianna Fáil, and I mean 10 years ago people were giving out stink about it, and many ministers have gone through that department and kept going. Now, I don't know, you know more about the inner workings of government. Is that the politicians or is that the civil servants, Pete?
Ooh, tricky one. Certainly what I would say is we actually collect as a state far less data on our citizens than most other European states do. We have far less tracking of our citizens than other European states, and the quality of our public services actually suffers as a result. There is a trade-off here between the efficiency and quality of public services and the degree to which we are happy for our state to have and hold information about us. And in that trade-off in a European context, we're actually pretty cautious about what information we get. We know far more about cattle in this country than we do about people. Now, you might expect an ESRI researcher to say something like that, because obviously, you know, data is our bread and butter, and being able to hold data on people and analyse it is our bread and butter. But I think there's a broader point for me here. I mean, the main story, until we actually see the full report from the commissioner, we're not actually really going to know what mistakes were made in the legal setup of this card.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think it's very hard to judge how serious those errors are at the moment, because not enough is in the public domain, and I gather it's going to come into the public domain. But I think there's a broader and more serious point. And the best way I can make it is all this kerfuffle over GDPR, right? I think that's a terrible piece of legislation. I mean, data is my bread and butter. I think it's a terrible piece of legislation.
Well, let's just pursue that a little bit, because some people have talked about it as a monster, but it was created in Europe to protect our privacy, when our privacy we were giving away like snuff at a wake.
And we still are. I mean, it's well-intentioned. It's designed to deal with a problem that is real, but it's incredibly cumbersome and complex, so it's really hard to understand. So, I mean, it is indescribable how much chaos it's caused within different parts of the public service. I mean, almost every agency and department I've dealt with, and I'm also the chairperson of a primary school, right, where we're volunteering to try and keep just a little school running. GDPR has caused absolute havoc in all of these places because it is so cumbersome, it is so complex, and the penalties if you get it wrong are quite
are quite staggering. Severe.
Yeah. Right,
so it's one of those things that's come along that is very, very well intentioned, but has actually, in essence, thrown sugar into the engine of our public services. Now, we don't know in this case, as I said yet, what the detail is as to what mistakes have been made. But the problem with GDPR, and this is where me as a behavioural scientist is going to come in, right, is that it has two premises that underpin the way it works. One is the people who gather data know exactly what they are going to do with it and for how long when they gather it. And the other is this idea that the people who are handing over the data can make an informed judgment about whether to hand over the data and give consent to it, understanding how it is going to be used. Both of those premises, from a behavioural point of view, are simply false. I mean, we work out as we go along.
Why are they false?
Well, because we work out as we go along how data can be used, and we see new opportunities to use it, and it's a creative process. And running any kind of service and any kind of large organisation, and particularly trying to solve those difficult things of joined-up government where, you know, you don't want to be duplicating data collection in multiple government departments when it's unnecessary. It's highly costly and it takes lots more time. Earlier in the programme, we're complaining about how long it takes our public service to solve problems.
Yes.
Well, if you put sugar in the engine of how it uses its data, it's bound to. Now, that's not to say there aren't really important issues about privacy. There are, and the digital age has introduced them. And it's a real problem. But at the moment, we're getting the answer wrong.
I see the Taoiseach on it. He put the figure at 4 million rather than 3 million people. The question is the legal basis, in the sense that social protection wanted this to prevent fraud. So you couldn't go into four different dole places and say, I am, I am, I am. And that seems to have been reasonably accepted, though clearly not by the woman who took the case, clearly not by her. So how do you strike the balance between those two requirements? I'll come to you, Malcolm, and then I'll go back to Pete.
Yeah, I suppose the point that Helen Dixon made in the Sunday Business Post article by Mark Rogan is that she used the term function creep, and that this idea that it was expanding all the time, the type of data and the type of information that they were gathering. I have to commend the Data Protection Commissioner, because there was a lot of scepticism about her role, about the role of the DPC, and in political circles as well, about would it have any teeth. But it's certainly shown in this case that it has teeth, and she has shown quite a lot of mettle in terms of what she described as a pretty damning report herself. Right. You know, will that extend out to the Facebooks, the Googles, the other types of remit that the DPC will have? But I do think that the point that Pete has raised is really, really interesting. And we certainly shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater on this one. There is an opportunity here. Would Fianna Fáil support legislation that might regularise or clarify the legal background to it?
Retrospectively.
Given that we're in the dying days of this government, I think that's unlikely.
So we face this thing. You're absolutely right, Marion. I mean, initially it was all to do with Social Security. Then you extend the use of this card. Now, as I say, we don't know the detail yet, but it appears that mistakes have been made from the legislative basis trying to extend the use of this card. But actually, it's incredibly important that we have really good identity checks on people who are applying for Irish passports and driving licences. It's really important. Do we want huge duplicatory systems that are trying to gather the same information? This is the issue here, right?
Mistakes
have been made putting it together, but we mustn't lose sight of where the force... You asked me whether it's come from the civil servants, whether it's come from the politicians. I think probably, in honesty, most of it's coming from the civil servants, because they're trying to make systems more efficient and better at tracking people, because we need them.
But I would have thought that your passport was like the ultimate identity card. You know, it's the thing that you were to value and that you were told never to let it out of your hands, and it allows you here, there and everywhere, and the Irish one has gone. So why would you need another identity to renew your passport?
But this is about citizenship applications. So right. I'm one of these people. So I have a public service card because I had to get one in order to put my citizenship application in because of the lunacy that's going on our other island. So finally it has become time for me to become properly Irish, even though I have this accent, because I've been here so long and this is where my family is and this is what I'm going to do, right? So I'm one of the people who's caught up in this. Also in that judgment that's been made about the residency requirements for citizenship. So my application is sitting on the pile at the moment.
Why is yours...
Oh, because of the judgment that was made about the residency requirements, that if you spend even a night off the island, you're not counted as a continuous resident, and we will see what happens with that. But I'm one of the people who's caught up in that. And in applying, I had to get myself a public service card. It was not hugely onerous. Should I really object to that as someone who's come from elsewhere in order to get Irish citizenship if it's the most efficient way of verifying my identity and pulling some documents together? I don't see why I should. I really don't.
Okay.
Just another interesting point. It was raised with me by an opposition TD when this broke during the week, that while we extended the necessity to have this card for passport applications, driver's applications, it wasn't put to use in perhaps an area which it really might be helpful, and that's health. And if we did use it in health, you'd be able to, let's say, have your GP records on hand when you go into an A&E, for example. With this,
if GDPR would let you.
Well, that's in
health, GDPR, I think, for a lot of the practitioners, not to mention patients who very rarely get money, is a nightmare.
Yeah, but the health system certainly does need to be upgraded.
It was to be used for a health portal that the HSE were going to...
And there has been, I think, a £225 million loan given by the European Investment Bank to go digital, especially in a hospital situation, so you don't have files on the end of a bed, which just seems ludicrous in this day and age. But that kind of joined up thinking where you know, if you did go into hospital in an emergency, they know, well, you have a history of X, Y and Z, or you've had this performed, or you have already had this examination, would make sense.
That would make sense.
And possibly could save lives.
For practitioners, patients and one and all, and travel, it would be good for the environment. You don't have to go to A, B, C, D to get records and to break through that thing to keep people informed. As a pensioner, says a caller, I found the card very convenient to access services. Yesterday, I was just had to read this before I read it, if you know what I mean. Yesterday, I got a worm dose for a dog at vets and had to sign GDPR. There's no problem with retaining and using anonymised data for research demographic analysis. GDPR does not preclude that. So that wouldn't affect you in the ESRI?
Yes and no. Actually, GDPR has affected us massively. Yes, there are certain exemptions for research, but how you handle data, how you manage it, how you get consent, all of that has had to change. It's spent many, many hours complying. We even have signs up in the lift about what to do if you notice a data breach. And some of the data breaches that can happen are remarkably trivial, but you are... Well, let me give you an example. So it's possible that you can be, as a researcher, in breach of... GDPR because you have sitting in your historical email records a bit of information about somebody that was given to you that counts as personal data, which is never going to be found by anybody, is never going to be used, and is sitting there because you exchanged a piece of information perfectly reasonably at the time, and you may notice that you're in breach and you have a responsibility then to do something about that breach. I mean, the problem with this legislation is it is so complicated and all-encompassing that it's almost impossible actually for an individual person to properly abide by it without it taking out a large chunk of their job. It's just the regulatory burden of it is just too great. I'd be fascinated to know how much regulatory burden it's really caused in the private companies that was actually introduced to try to deal with. But the regulatory
burden... Which was the ones Malcolm was talking
absolutely,
about.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But the regulatory burden that is placed on state organisations, including very small ones that are run by volunteers and are not very well funded...
Charity.
Is enormous.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm surprised that you were also mild-mannered about it because, of accepting it, because listening to the airwaves, it sounded like everybody thought that this card was a disgrace. You know, people had behaved irresponsibly, off with their head. Well, that comes out a lot nowadays with the minister in question, but you don't take that
view.
No,
well, I mean, you know, there obviously the criticism from way back had been levelled by the Irish Council for Civil Liberties and Digital Rights Ireland, and I think that those are valid concerns that weren't listened to, and I think that's the point here. I think the nub of it that came out in Helen Dixon's report is the fact that these consistent, reasonable calls to have it checked were not taken on board by government.
And reports were sent to the department alerting them to reports. Anyway, we will leave it there for the moment. Thank you very much, and we will take a break.
Podcast The Marian Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.